Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
We will be one people under one God. One people under one God.
Under one God, saluting one American flag. One American flag.
But as Christians, at least, we do have to kind of sit back and be like, okay, at what point do we decide we're not part of the American culture anymore? We're not a subculture of the American thinking anymore.
You can't make the argument that sexual diversity is good because God said of everything that he made in Genesis 1 that it was good.
This is Alex in Northwest Indiana, and I am an Uber listener.
Philosophy is important. It really is. Now, it might seem to be an esoteric subject, something that only those interested in ancient civilizations would be interested in as well, but that's not true. Everyone is a philosopher, just like everyone is a theologian. If you think you're a philosopher, if you have preconceived notions, if you think things through, and if you have a way of thinking, you are a philosopher. Christians are so as well. But in the modern philosophy classroom, Philosophy 101, if you will, there are challenges to the Christian way of thinking. Some of them are boilerplate challenges that you may meet in every philosophy course you begin. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Monday afternoon, September the 19th. We're going to begin a series we're calling Classroom Apologetics, kind of going from one classroom to another. Today it'll be Philosophy 101 and answering the challenges that Christians find there to their worldview and to their way of thinking and even to their faith. Dr. Angus Manoj will be our guest. Now, a little bit later, Pastor Tom Baker will be with us to teach our weekly Sunday school lesson on Deborah the Prophetess. We'll be in Judges chapters 4 and 5. Dr. Angus Manoj is a regular guest. He's professor and chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He's also president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. Dr. Manoj, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you for having me.
How is philosophy typically presented in the secular classroom?
Well, one of the problems is you get the sense from a number of set pieces in the class that Christian theism, Christian belief, is irrelevant to the main questions of philosophy. This happens in ethics, the theory of right and wrong, epistemology, how you know, and metaphysics, what is real. And the way this is done is through some set pieces or vignettes which are used to convince the student that their beliefs about God are going to be irrelevant to these issues, and so they have to be bracketed. And of course, if the student comes to think that God is irrelevant to all the big questions, they may just conclude that there is no God, or at least they will have a very narrow, privatized faith.
One of the set pieces that we're going to talk about here, it's not a familiar name to many, but maybe even the idea itself will prove to be familiar, called the Euthyphro Dilemma. Where does it come from? What is it?
The Euthyphro Dilemma originates in a dialogue from Plato, which deals with the time just before Socrates goes on trial. And it's dealing in a polytheistic context, but it can easily be applied to Christian theism as well. Christians believe that we can determine right and wrong by God's command. That's being called the divine command theory of ethics, and you see that in Augustine. Well, the Euthyphro Dilemma asks this question: well, is something good just because God commands it, or does God command it because it's good? And both of these seem to lead to trouble. If you say something is good because God commands it, that makes goodness arbitrary, and it seems we'd have to say that if God commanded us to torture babies for fun, that would be good. And on the other hand, if we say, well, God commands it because it's good, then it seems that goodness is independent of God, and even God must consult an independent standard. And this will lead the student to conclude that either way, God cannot be the explanation of goodness, and then the professor will typically explain, well, this is why we have to pursue secular ethics and recommend utilitarianism or Kantianism or some other secular approach to ethics.
What is the best response to the Euthyphro dilemma?
Well, the first point to notice is the Christian doesn't believe that things are right just because God commands them. It's not the mere power that he commands them. It's because God, a perfectly good being, commands them. So it's not God's power that makes his commands right, but his nature. So although God does have the power to command anything, it's not in his nature to do so. We see that in Numbers 23:19, where it says that God is not a man that he would lie. And in Titus 1:2, often translated to say, God cannot lie. Well, God does have the power to lie, but it's not in his nature to do so. So what constrains God there is his nature, the kind of being that he is. And God does command things because they're good, but that goodness isn't independent of him. He is the source of all that is good. He is the supremely good being. And so really, the Euthyphro dilemma is a false dilemma. We don't say that things are good simply because God says so. When God creates, we see that he saw that what he made was good. Well, why was it good? Well, because he is a perfectly good being, and the things that he make reflect that goodness.
So in other words, we've got about a minute or so before we take our break. In other words, if you're in a pagan, ancient Greek pagan context, the gods were arbitrary. They were like men. They behaved in arbitrary ways. The Christian response is, well, the true God is not arbitrary.
Right, that's right. They had war among the gods, and the gods clearly had evil desires and conflicting desires. They weren't consistent. The Christian believes in one consistent, perfect, good God. And so, of course, his commands are not arbitrary. And, of course, what he commands is related to his own goodness.
Dr. Manoj, the second set piece that you wanted to deal with here has to do with a philosopher named Hume and miracles. Who was Hume?
David Hume was an 18th century skeptical Scottish philosopher. And one of the things that he argued was that we could never have knowledge of God's actions in the world in his famous argument against miracles. And it's an in principle argument. He says you should never believe testimony of a miracle, for example, a man being raised from the dead, because we have uniform experience of people dying and staying dead. And so when we weigh the testimony against that uniform experience, the scales are not going to balance, and we should never believe that testimony.
Okay, so what is the reply to that argument?
What's wrong with Hume's argument is that if it were correct, we could never discover anything new. We can take an example from science itself. Before Einstein, scientists had uniform experience of light traveling in straight lines. Einstein's relativity theory predicted that light would bend around massive objects. A crazy prediction, it seemed, but then during a total eclipse in 1919, it was confirmed by Arthur Eddington. Now, if Hume's logic were correct, because we had this uniform evidence of light not bending, no one should have believed Eddington. And we would not have been able to confirm this amazing prediction of relativity theory. Obviously, that's wrong, and we know that Einstein was right. Richard Whately gives a similar example in history. He points out that Napoleon Bonaparte was a man so singular and unprecedented in history that we simply shouldn't believe, he's doing satire, any of the reports that we have of his existence, because we have uniform testimony of no such person existing prior to his existence. And by similar arguments, any remarkable figure like Socrates or Abraham Lincoln, we should conclude that they never existed at all. And what he's doing is he's confusing two kinds of logic. Where you're dealing with frequent events, including, of course, people dying and staying dead, you'd use inductive logic. But the proper logic for finding out what happened in history is abductive. You have a variety of possible explanations for a singular historical event. You can't have Abraham Lincoln die twice if you want to figure out the best explanations of his death. And so you don't look at the frequency, you look at the particular facts surrounding this particular event in history, and you infer the best explanation.
And isn't it true that, strictly speaking, all events, not just miracles, but all events in history are singular events?
Yes, it is true. In all their particularity, every single event is unique. And so I like to give this humorous example to my students. They come in and they tell me they just got married. And perhaps I even went to the wedding, but I say, I'm sorry. You know, it's just your word and my word. That is completely overwhelmed by all the evidence we had for the preceding 20 years of your not being married. So it must be false that you're married. That shows the absurdity of the logic here. So it would wipe out not just miracles, but in fact each particular event in history.
So there's no, in response to Hume, there's no reason in principle to dismiss miracles a priori.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is. It's an attempt to rule out miracles a priori, and what you need to do is investigate the facts. He does spend a little of time on that, but it's extremely inadequate, and you set, you know, that by the side of more recent approaches to miracles, and it's very feeble indeed. The issue is a matter of fact, and fact is what matters here.
Another one of the set pieces is what you call the mind-body problem. How would you describe it to us?
Well, the classic mind-body problem is always raised in discussions of Descartes because he has the mind and anything physical as two different kinds of substances. The mind is in time but not space, but bodies are in both time and space. Then the objection is, well, how can two substances, which are so very different, possibly interact? And that then leads one to think, well, you have to be a materialist because a physical brain is in space and time just like any other physical object, so that would solve the problem. However, what this overlooks is the incompatibility of this approach with, oddly enough, David Hume.
Hmm.
Hume was the one who quite rightly pointed out something accepted by the majority of philosophers, and that is that we can see no logical connection between cause and effect. There's no similarity between a drop in temperature and water turning to ice. There's no logical connection there at all. We simply learn that it's a fact that a drop in temperature leads water to turn to ice, and we can be justified in believing that even if we don't know how it happens. Likewise, as Richard Swinburne points out, we're very justified in believing that if you stick a pin in someone, physical event, they will feel pain subjectively, a mental event. That's true even if we can't give a full account of how it happens. So the mere fact that we puzzle about how mind and body can interact is not at all a good reason to deny that they interact. And notice what's at stake here. It will certainly threaten traditional ideas about the soul, but if this approach is correct, it's also trying to undermine the idea that God could do anything, because God is an immaterial being, and so the same question can be raised there. And we need to insist that our evidence is that the immaterial and the material interact all the time. And by the way, this comes up in contexts where even the naturalist can't really deny it. For example, mathematics. Where is the number four? Where is a triangle? They're not in space, and yet we can think about numbers and triangles.
And yet this is one, you say, that is routinely trotted out at the beginning of Philosophy 101.
William Hasker, an eminent philosopher of mine, says that for him, this is the most overrated philosophical objection of all time. It goes against what philosophers say about causation in other contexts, and yet it's routinely trotted out as a piece of propaganda that will lead you to believe that you have to take a materialistic approach in the philosophy of mind.
So what the problem with the mind-body problem philosophically and then its application elsewhere, is that it just simply proves too much.
Yeah, it does. It does prove too much. If you really accept this embargo on interaction between things which are unlike, you're going to find you're going to have problem in physics. There are bizarre things that happen in physics, and they just do happen. There's no logical connection. It's going to come up when you think about mathematical objects and our logical reasoning, where we appear to interact with abstract objects. And so this argument is far too strong. It would actually undercut their own position.
Dr. Angus Manoogia is our guest, president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society and professor and chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. It's our series, Classroom Apologetics, Philosophy 101. When we come back, a frontal assault on the existence of God.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Over and over again, I tried to let the entire book reflect this, that the holiness of all the saints is only the holiness of Jesus reflected in their lives.
Pastor Will Wheaton, author of the new book, Celebrating the Saints.
And this holiness of Christ is the thing which the saints grabbed onto in faith, and it illumined their lives.
You can purchase Celebrating the Saints by calling 1-800-325-3040 or at issuesetc.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performancefitness618.com.
Our cities are some of the greatest mission fields on the planet, but the footprint of the church is shrinking. We dare not shrink from our cities. Christ is needed now in our urban areas. From chaos, turmoil, decay, death, and destruction, Jesus brings peace, hope, resurrection, eternal life, and rebuilding. And you can help by being a hero for the city. Find out how at lcms.org/citymission or on Facebook at LCMS City Mission. Every city needs a hero. Capes and helmets not required.
We're doing our series, Classroom Apologetics. Today it's Philosophy 101 with Dr. Angus Manoogia, professor and chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options for an associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree. They'll even waive your application fee when you use that promo code ISSUES. You can find out more by clicking the Concordia University, Wisconsin logo at issuesetc.org. Lifelong Lutheran Learning, Concordia University, Wisconsin Online. The next set piece that you wanted to deal with here, Dr. Manoogia, is really a frontal assault on the existence of God, arguments against his existence. What do those arguments look like?
Well, you know, in a typical intro to philosophy course, you'll look at some of the main arguments of the existence of God, and one of them is the cosmological argument. For example, William Lane Craig's simple version, whatever begins to exist has a cause, the universe began to exist, so the universe has a cause, and that would need to be a supernatural being, namely God. Well, the critic likes to say, well, what explains God, or who made God? Ignoring the fact that God is a necessary being, ignoring the idea of aseity or self-existence, the argument wasn't whatever exists has a cause, it was whatever begins to exist has a cause. An eternal being doesn't require a causal explanation. And then, of course, their retort is, well, why couldn't the universe be this infinite or eternal being? That's rather interesting, though, because it denies all the scientific evidence that we have, that it's expanding, the background radiation. And furthermore, even if we did think the universe was infinite, it still seems to be contingent because it's nothing but a complex of contingent things. We have the question, why does something exist rather than nothing? It doesn't seem the universe has to exist because each of its parts could certainly conceivably be removed. And furthermore, there's something wrong, it seems, with the whole idea of an infinite collection of physical things. David Hilbert imagines a hotel that's infinitely big. Well, if you have an infinitely big hotel, you say, all right, we'll have an infinite number of guests. And suppose you do, and now it's completely full from room one on. Now you'd like to have some more guests. So what you do is you move all those guests to the even number rooms. Since there are an infinite number of even numbers, you can actually accommodate all of your guests in the even number rooms and have an infinite number of vacancies in the odd rooms. So that seems to be absurd. First it was full, and now with the same number of guests, so it would seem, you have an infinite number of vacancies. So this suggests that the idea of affinity doesn't really fit properly with the physical world.
The notion of the universe itself being the uncontingent thing, aren't they just trading one ground of being for another?
Yeah, that's what it comes down to, is the attempt to divinize nature against all the evidence that we have, that it has an origin, it came into being, and therefore that it is contingent.
Just one more question, and I want to kind of harken back to the mention of David Hume before. It seems as though some of these arguments are, including Hume's, classically begging the question, presuming, rather deftly presuming, what you seek to prove.
Yeah, Hume tries to smuggle in the idea that nobody ever has witnessed a miracle before. And of course, that goes against the principle of historical investigation. We ought to find out. There are many historical reports and also many contemporary reports, as you see in Craig Keener's two-volume collection on miracle reports. So to say that we have uniform evidence against them is assuming that every single one of those testimonies is false. And likewise, assuming that God has to have a cause is really just a way of begging the question against the idea of a necessary eternal being, an uncaused being that does not require a cause.
Dr. Manoj, I'm curious here, with these four set pieces that we have laid out here, they're fairly easy to refute, and it doesn't take a philosophy major to do so. How in the world do they persist as the stock and trade often in the secular philosophy classroom?
Well, I think they persist because they have abandoned a real rigorous dialectical approach to presenting philosophy. So there are certain texts that you encounter and you hear their point of view, and then you move on to something else and that's left to do its work. And really, this is poor scholarship. It's because so many secular philosophers in the academy do not read or take seriously their best critics among extant and historical Christian philosophers. There are many great contemporary replies to Hume, for example, and there are many recent replies by John Earman or Robert Larmor or Craig Keener that they ought to know about, and yet they don't consult these sources. So the sad thing is, I don't think people today are really getting a fair presentation of the true dialectic of the situation. And can I say, I think that if you go to a strong Christian school, one that won't hide people from the secular views, but one that will expose them to both sides, the best challenges and the best Christian responses, they're going to get a better education in philosophy as well as a chance to hold on to their faith.
So you're saying that rather than accepting these simple ideas, and there are others that we could discuss, but instead challenging them is actually a better way to do and to learn philosophy.
It is. It's faithful to Socrates himself, the approach of dialectic. Every position you would expect if it's interesting, there will be people who challenge it. We shouldn't be in the business of presenting settled results in philosophy any more than in science. We should talk about settled science, which is really antithetical to the whole idea of science as you know, as a tentative and falsifiable affair. So it's really good for students to just hear those both of those sides and start to think for themselves.
How does the Christian way of thinking, how does it actually benefit from knowing these opposing viewpoints and knowing how to respond to them?
Well, we're called by Paul in Colossians 2:8, where he says, "See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to the traditions of this world, and not according to Christ." It will benefit us because if we don't recognize our philosophy, know what our worldview is, we will very easily be taken in and combine an alien philosophy with our faith. That's bad for us. And those of us who have philosophical training have an obligation to help other people not be taken captive. As C.S. Lewis put it so beautifully, good philosophy must exist if for no other reason than that bad philosophy must be answered.
Talk, if you would, or make the case, if you would, for Christians in general, not just college students, but Christians in general, having a working knowledge, at least, of at least the ideas that we've discussed here tonight.
Yeah, the case is this. Everyone will have a worldview. That is to say, they will have a way of looking at the world, what they think is real, how you know, and how you ought to live. Everybody has a worldview in that sense that dictates the whole course that their life takes. So the question is, will it be conscious or unconscious? Will it be unexamined or examined? Will it be false or true? Will it have evil consequences or good consequences? And to get a sense of that, to give a rather horrifying example, Robert J. Lifton's book, The Nazi Doctors, where it describes the philosophy that led people to believe in the health of the society on an analogy with the health of an organism. And they say, well, the organism is healthier if it gets rid of certain unhealthy cells. And likewise, the nation of Germany would be healthier if it eliminated the unfit, which they proceeded to do in the child and adult euthanasia programs in the 1930s. That idea, a very consistent idea, had horrible consequences because it wasn't examined. It wasn't contrasted with other views. So if we refuse to think about our assumptions, it can lead us into terrible errors, it can be destructive to our faith, and it can also lead us to do terrible things. Everybody, therefore, needs to have enough philosophy to recognize their own worldview, to distinguish it from other worldviews, to assess their value, to assess their degree of compatibility with the Christian faith.
Talk about this concept that is introduced in Scripture in perhaps a different context, but certainly has application here, and that is the mind of Christ. When you talk about a Christian worldview, you're really talking about a Christian way of thinking not only about God and matters of salvation, but about every aspect of life and even the life of the mind.
Yeah, Romans 12:2, where it talks about being transformed by the renewal of your mind. And so that you think not according, it says, to the patterns of this world. The Christian mind, what that really refers to is the idea the Christian faith has implications for how we should think about every aspect of our life. How should we think about science? How should we think about the environment? There's a distinctive Christian approach to environmental stewardship. It's not the same as the secular approach. There are areas of agreement, but it isn't the same. We ought to use philosophy to develop the implications from Scripture for all of our thinking and for all of our life in every area that we can, so that we begin to see that Paul is right when he says in Colossians 1:17 that Christ is before all things and in him all things hold together. That isn't just flowery rhetoric. It says that everything makes most and best sense as it relates to Christ. And the more I've studied philosophy, the more I see that that is true. For example, the problem of evil has a much better solution if Christ is in the center of it than if it's merely the philosopher's problem of God and evil. Christ makes a difference to that problem.
So finally, should Christians pursue philosophy?
I think very much so, because we now have a culture where worldviews and ideas that are antithetical to Christianity are becoming dominant. We live in a post-Christian society, and Christians need defense. If you don't develop a defense, then most likely you'll simply go with the flow and acquire your ideas for the culture. They'll set the defaults. Just like when you go into a word processing program, there are certain defaults if you do nothing. I'm afraid a lot of people are doing nothing. Their mind is in neutral, and they're accepting the culture's defaults. What philosophy teaches is critical distance, how you step back, reconsider, and can criticize those and consider their compatibility with your faith. Then your faith becomes so much more important because it starts to illuminate every aspect of your life rather than just being a tiny fragment of it.
Dr. Angus Manoj is professor and chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He's president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. Dr. Manoj, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks very much, Todd.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Pastor Tom Baker of Law and Gospel. We teach a Sunday school lesson with him every week. And today, on this Monday afternoon, September the 19th, it's going to be Deborah the prophetess in Judges chapters 4 and 5. There's no doubt that Deborah is a judge. What's the story of her being a prophetess? Does that mean that women should be pastors today if Deborah was a prophetess then? We'll answer that question right after this. I'm talking with regular guest Dr. Ken Sherb about a new book by one of his former professors. Which one, Ken?
The late Dr. Kurt Marquardt. And the book is The Saving Truth, Doctrine for Lay People.
You edited this book.
Yeah, the unpublished manuscript was among Marquardt's papers, and it is vintage Marquardt, lively, engaging, centering in the Christ who saves, with an apologetics chapter at the end.
You can find out more about Saving Truth, Doctrine for Lay People at lutheracademy.com.
A confessional liturgical Lutheran congregation in southeast Michigan in Rochester Hills. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word. That's LCIW.org. We gather for the divine service every Sunday, 9:30 a.m. at Lutheran High School Northwest. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word. Find us on the internet at lciw.org.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit wittenbergacademy.org.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you have skills as a coder, designer, writer, marketer, project manager, or are interested in building websites? Do you want to help the church proclaim Christ and Him crucified to the digital world that we live in? If yes, you should join our WordSites team. WordSites is a group of tech-savvy volunteers who help fellow Lutheran organizations build effective websites. Plus, we have fun while we're doing it. To submit your name or to learn more, visit WordSites.org. WordSites. Your confessional Lutheran website, reformed.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.